have been countless movies about real and fictional musicians. And in the new movie The High Note, Tracy Ellis Ross plays the fictional legendary singer Grace Davis.
Dakota Johnson plays Maggie, an aspiring record producer and Grace's personal assistant. The two women have to figure out everything from whether Maggie has a future in the music industry to whether Grace should take a residency in Vegas. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about the new movie The High Note on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Stephen, it's just you and me today.
Yeah.
From our remote studios here to just have the hot goss about this rare entry, which is an actual new film that before all this started, the trailers were out. It was going to be a big theatrical release. They've gone ahead with it as an on-demand release. I want to get to so many things, but you are my music go-to guy. So what did you think?
Yeah, watching this movie, I felt like we need to find a new name for this genre. This is the kind of movie that gets billed as a romantic comedy out of the absence of a more accurate descriptor. This is really like a light drama. I think it does a disservice to it to call it a rom-com. It's too low stakes for drama, but it is exactly the kind of movie that you want to watch on an airplane or on your couch in the afternoon. I don't think this is a movie that necessarily ever really needed to be in theaters, even in the before times. I think it's perfectly situated for people to watch it at home because it's light, it's dramatic, it's musical, the cast is charming, it's fun, it is not massively memorable, it is not a major movie, but I enjoyed it. Now, speaking to the musical element of it, this is the kind of movie where, like, I don't know how its budget breaks down, but I would estimate 50% of this film's budget was spent licensing songs, and about another 40% of it was spent writing convincing songs that these performers could sing that would seem like the kind of songs that people in their position might perform.
Yeah, you know, my favorite thing about it is we haven't yet mentioned that there's a performance here by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's sort of in everything. He was in Waves. He's having like this big moment where you see him all over the place. He plays a young singer who Maggie becomes interested in potentially producing, and he also becomes her love interest. And the fact that we didn't mention that off the top, and then you talked about how it was easy to think of it as sort of something of a rom-com, makes me think a lot of people are currently wondering whether this is a movie where Tracy Ellis Ross is potentially going to date Dakota Johnson. And I was like, I would watch that movie, maybe.
I would watch that movie.
That might have been an interesting movie. I agree with you. I think it's a real kind of like pitch right down the middle. I think it's pretty good at being what it is. Now, there are a couple things that are very, I think, conspicuous in the creation of this film that you just have to deal with, even though there's not that much to be said about it. It is this young white record producer surrounded by a bunch of black singers and, in the case of the character played by Ice Cube, a manager, who it's a little odd watching her kind of explain music careers to Tracy Ellis Ross and Ice Cube in particular. But I don't know how that's going to strike people. I'm really curious to hear how that comes off. It is directly addressed at one point. There's a moment when Grace kind of talks about the role of race in her career because she's a kind of a middle-aged singer. And she talks about black women and the dearth of opportunities that she feels she may have to be relevant. Here's my other thing about this movie, though. Why are they so disrespectful to the Vegas residency? Because it's basically, should Grace make a new record or should Grace have a Vegas residency?
Right.
Now, the film's outlook, and this is not a spoiler because it's so obvious, the film's outlook is Grace has to follow her heart and write her new music, and Maggie is just the person to encourage her to do that. But look, you could do a lot worse than a Vegas residency. They treat it like if you go to Vegas, you are automatically David Copperfield. You know what I mean? They treat it like you might as well step onto an ice floe if you go to Vegas. You know who's been playing Vegas? Lady Gaga, Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah.
Like, just how hot is Grace supposed to be as an artist that she's too good for Vegas? If you love performing in front of crowds, right? And God knows, we all look forward to the time when we can love performing in front of crowds again. If you love performing in front of crowds and you don't want to fly everywhere every 24 hours for 6 months, go to Vegas. It's a good idea.
Seriously, you are so right and all over my notes. I wrote down, the stakes are so low in this movie that the worst case scenario is that Grace Davis is going to go make $100 million on the Vegas Strip. And there's this whole subplot. The Ice Cube character, her manager, is basically saying, like, look, I've been managing you for a zillion years. I would like to take my cut of your Vegas residency. And I'm sitting there like, of course.
He's her manager.
He's her manager. He's not wrong.
He's not Kermit the Frog sitting in the swamp telling you to follow your dreams into the Rainbow Connection. He's her manager. This is the right thing for her manager to do. Go to Vegas. And also, basically, like, he's saying, this is the right thing for this moment in your career. Whereas other people are like, people want to know when you're going to write another hit. I'm like, really? Would that be the case? Write another hit. This woman at this point in what we are led to believe is her career. And on top of that, I must say, there is a chat between Ice Cube and somebody. I think it's Maggie. In which Ice Cube gives an explanation of Bruce Springsteen that is supposedly the cynical, wrong take on the career of Bruce Springsteen. And I was like, that is true. It's basically people don't want him to come out and noodle around with a bunch of his new folk music that nobody ever heard of. People want to hear Thunder Road. And I was like, I think that's accurate. Like, I understand maybe that's the wrong thing to believe, but I think it's true.
I think it speaks to the level of tension in this movie, that the movie presents the choice between two perfectly reasonable approaches.
Right, totally. And it's just earth-shattering which one of them you pick. And I must say, Stephen, you're the music guy. You can tell me whether this is true.
Yeah.
So there's a conversation between Maggie and the character played by Calvin Harrison. His name is David, and he's this young musician. She's kind of getting to know. They're sort of flirting. And he asks her, like, her California musicians dinner party or something like that. The people she names are Brian Wilson, mm-hmm. Nina Simone, mm-hmm. and Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. Now, look, those are all great musicians, right? Those might even be people that I would name myself. But here's the thing. Those might even be people I would name, and I don't know anything about music. So the fact that this is supposed to, one of the things that you're supposed to be picking up is that, like, she's this really soulful person who really understands and loves music. I'm like, because she knows about Sam Cooke and Nina Simone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that is both accurate and basic.
Yeah, I mean, this movie's view of musical authenticity and its ways of signposting her musical authenticity is really rooted in a vision of music that's situated around 1971. It's a lot of singer-songwriters. It's a lot of classic soul music. And if I can defend it for a moment, I think this movie, as much as you have a few of these kind of uneasy scenes where it's like the young white lady teaches black music industry professionals how to be authentic, I think as squicky as some of those scenes are, I do appreciate the fact that this movie is allowing a young woman to be as encyclopedically obsessed with music as young dudes are. We have seen 1,000 depictions of young dudes with encyclopedic knowledge of every B-side ever recorded. And this was clearly an effort to show, like, young women are also obsessed with music all the time. And I could see the efforts to do that. And I did appreciate that. I also just want to quickly say as an aside, I like the fact that this movie cast Dakota Johnson in this charming lead role. Dakota Johnson was in the 50 Shades of Grey movies and has been really maligned for those performances, but is a very gifted young actress. And I did appreciate the casting of her in this role. There are several casting choices in this movie that I did enjoy and appreciate. I think the casting of, I'm surprised we haven't mentioned it yet, of Tracy Ellis Ross, daughter of Diana Ross.
Right, of course.
It's an ingenious bit of kind of stunt casting to have Tracy Ellis Ross play a veteran pop soul diva.
Right.
I think the casting of Ice Cube is clever.
He's funny in this. I liked him in this.
He is funny in this. I wrote down an angry Lil Rel Howery is kind of the energy that he's bringing to this. I mean, I think there's some real charm in this movie, but I also think it's not aiming for anything challenging. This is exactly the kind of movie to watch for the first time in your house instead of at a theater.
You know, you said defend, and I don't necessarily think it needs defending. I think this is one of those fun movies where, as you can tell, I have a lot of fun making fun of silly things about it. But ultimately, was I bored or eager for it to be over? Mm-hmm. Not particularly. I was enjoying myself. I love Tracee Ellis Ross.
Yeah.
I think Dakota Johnson is fine in this, although I will say there's this appearance by Bill Pullman, who plays Maggie's father. And, you know, Dakota Johnson's actual father is Don Johnson, and this could have just been Don Johnson. I didn't understand why it wasn't just him, because it's a very Don Johnson part at this moment in his career.
It really is.
But there's a lot to kind of like about the movie. And one of the things that I talked about with our own producer, Jessica Reedy, who is not a get on the mic kind of producer, unlike Maggie. But one of the things she said was, it's interesting to see a movie that is about music production, because I think a lot of people don't know a lot about music production. Now, fair question, does this movie know very much about music production? Because to me, music producers, according to this movie, this is what they do. They listen to your music while blissing out in a chair with headphones on. And they say that the bass should be louder or something else should be louder. Do you really get a feel for what music production is here? No. And I could have used, like, what I really wanted was like a process moment in which you really got to see how a music producer transforms a piece. One of the things that's weird is that one of the things that Maggie spends a lot of time producing is a live album. And it's like, I know you have to be really good at producing a live album, but it kind of means you have a limited palette to explain what it is she's doing.
Right.
So I'm not sure the movie really understands or explains music production.
I think basic is kind of describing this movie's approach to music pretty much in general.
Yeah, I don't really have anything against this movie. I kind of like it. Sort of opens up in a different way in about the last 15 minutes. I kind of wanted to spend a little bit more time in that. That's a warmer idea of Grace as a character.
Yeah.
And I felt like I knew her a little better. You know, I would shift that around. But like, some of my favorite movies to curl up on the couch with are ones where I could spend at least this much time making fun of various weird things about them. And it never bothers me at all. So I think if you're looking for a vodcom for a weekend, this is probably a perfectly fine example, with the caveat that it is a white girl explaining the music industry to Ice Cube at certain times, and it does feel a little bit weird in that regard. But I did enjoy it on the whole. If you happen to watch The High Note, let us know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Purple Mattress. The secret to Purple is the Purple Grid. It's a patented comfort technology designed to instantly adapt to your body's natural shape and sleep style. With over 2,800 open air channels and naturally temperature neutral gel, every Purple Mattress comes with free shipping, returns, and a risk-free 100-night trial. Visit purple.com/happyhour and use promo code happyhour for a special offer. Terms apply.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week? Steve and Thompson, it's just me and you, so you better go first.
All right. So back in March, we did our South by Southwest episode, even though South by Southwest did not happen. And we had Linda and Glenn and myself pick our favorite songs from the Austin 100, that list of South by Southwest discoveries. And Glenn very wisely picked a song called Sucker by the band Vistas, this wonderful Scottish power pop band. They were one of my very, very favorite discoveries from that process. Today, May 29th, Vista's debut album is out. It is called Everything Changes in the End. And it has been a really, really long time since I have heard an album that feels like it's like a dozen hits deep. These are 200 proof weapons grade joy bombs full of hand claps and shout along choruses, dramatic pauses before slamming into big guitars, heavily Scottish accented. I don't know if I would like describe it as like a cross between like The Proclaimers and Andrew W.K. and Fountains of Wayne somehow. You could drop the needle anywhere on this record, but let's hear the opening of a song from this album called 15 Years. And I can move. At this moment in history, we talk a lot about pop culture in quarantine as being comfort food and like music that kind of settles our nerves or TV that gives us comfort. It's also summertime, and this album is all about buoyancy and like summertime joy. And it's a shame that we can't all, you know, rock this music in concert together, at least in the near term. But I don't think we should forget about music that brings joy. This is going to be one of my absolute favorite albums of the year. I love it so much. The band is called Vistas. The album is called Everything Changes in the End.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. That's lifted my spirits already. Although if I were the producer, I would have turned up the bass. So what I brought is the documentary that is, as you're hearing this, the first part of it has aired on ESPN and the second part is coming this coming up Sunday. It's called Lance, and this is ESPN's effort to kind of capitalize on the large audience they got for the Michael Jordan and the Bulls documentary, The Last Dance, which we talked about. They moved up a couple of documentaries that they had scheduled for later in the year, and one of them is this Lance Armstrong documentary. Now, unlike the Michael Jordan documentary, Lance Armstrong was not a producer of this documentary about himself, which gives me greater comfort. He sat for long interviews. And for me, what you get from this documentary is him trying very hard to take responsibility for what he did in terms of doping and cycling, and then sort of move on, but constantly fighting his own desire to say it actually wasn't his fault. It actually wasn't a big deal. It actually was everyone else's fault. You know, he should never have been judged so harshly in the first place. It's a battle between him and himself over whether he can fully kind of embrace the idea of regret. Spoiler alert, no. Because he is who he is. And I think in that way, it's a very sharp portrait. I think the first segment, which is the one that's already aired, spends a little more time kind of on his background and the background of all the kind of the way he became a famous cyclist. It's in the back half that you get a little bit more of the dark side kind of stuff. I found it fascinating. I don't know if I think it's as fascinating as The Last Dance. If it is, it's fascinating in a kind of a different way. But I really enjoyed it. I think it's really well made, and I think it is what I want from a documentary like this, which is I think it is revealing about who he is, especially if you haven't seen some of the other documentary work that's been done on him. It's well worth a watch, I think. And again, that's called Lance. You can find it on ESPN. You can stream it. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find us both on Twitter. I'm at Linda Holmes and Steven is at I Dislike Steven. Our great producer, Jessica Reedy, is Jessica_Reedy, our hero of our movie. And our producer, Mike Katziff, same thing, is at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. Thanks for being here with me, Steven.
Thank you, Holmesy.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's over at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week, where we're going to offer a guide to the new streaming service, HBO Max.
The news has been hard to escape. So take a deep breath and join us for NPR's All Songs Considered. It's more than a music discovery podcast. It's relief, with new episodes every Tuesday and Friday as we share the week's best new albums and lots of music to calm the nerves. Hear All Songs Considered wherever you get podcasts.